I talked with Chickasaw Federation President Donovan Taylor and defense attorney Brandon Lawrence about Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin and her ongoing controversies. Councilwoman Shanklin has faced back-to-back-to-back news stories now, questioning her judgment. Is this not a matter of if an ethics complaint will be filed against her, but when?
It looks like it. I think, and like you alluded to, it's a question of judgment. It's a question of judgment, and I do think that with all the media publicity, and actually in the editorials in the Courier Journal that you see, is they give a 1-800 number.
They give the number to the tip line.
Right. I mean,
they're literally instructing people, call the tip line.
I think it's just a matter of time. When you read the editorial and when you read the viewer responses, I think it's just a matter of time.
The first story was her hiring her grandson, Gary Bowler, who at the time was a fugitive, who has a long criminal history, drug trafficking, drug charges, domestic violence, been working in her office for a number of years, earned about $34,000. Story after that was this jobs program, this upholstery program for felons, which no felons were referred to that by Metro Corrections. And we end up finding out that Councilman Shanklin, she was in the program, just doing her own thing with her reupholstering her couch. And this latest story that through the Petersburg-Newburgh Improvement Association, that she was signing checks personally, some of which paid family members for certain activities. Donovan, you work at the community level with a neighborhood association of your own in Chickasaw. I mean, is this very similar to what happened last year with Councilwoman Green?
I mean, you can say in a lot of ways, because when it goes to the point that one of the clear points that they made out against Councilwoman Green was she actually was the one who was not as necessarily signing the checks, but directing how the money was to be spent to certain employees under that Green Summer Jobs Program. And so basically she was directing how the money was to be spent and how these checks are to be written. In this case, you know, it's considered evidence shows that Councilwoman Shanklin actually was the one who actually not only just, you know, directed the checks, but actually wrote out the checks herself.
So for people, I mean, we've seen similar. The details are different, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But Councilwoman Green said, everyone remember, she said clearly, other council members are doing this too.
Right.
And she specifically named Shanklin. She said, there's someone up here who hired their grandson, and that's a problem. Why isn't that an ethics complaint?
She said that. I mean, but then when you get into the finger pointing, I don't buy into the excuse that everybody's doing it.
No, not an excuse.
And I'm not saying
that certainly didn't exonerate Councilwoman Green and what she
exactly,
did.
Exactly.
I think that's why Councilwoman Green was making that argument.
Right.
But it's coming true. I mean, it's in the sense of there's a lot more scrutiny and focus. And the fact is, Councilwoman Shanklin was one of the five people who filed the petition to have Green removed. So there was additional scrutiny on her anyway.
Absolutely. It looks like you've got the appearance of impropriety. I mean, there hasn't been an ethics investigation as far as we know. But it from the surface, it looks like there's an appearance of impropriety. And you asked, what are the people saying about it? You've got a camp that's loyal to Dr. Shanklin. You got a camp that says what's right is right, what's wrong is wrong. You've got to suffer the consequences. And it looks like you've got people that read the Courier that have made comments that say that it looks like business as usual, like it's corruption, small-time corruption. And you've got the article today that says that this is a widespread thing within city council, it looks like.
Yeah, the audit that came out today reviewed neighborhood development funds for the past two fiscal years, 117 grants for about $1.9 million. Half of those grants, the audit finds, lack proper documentation, whether allowable expenditures, whether we don't have proof of purchase. I believe there are at least $238,000 where we see an expenditure by the nonprofit that received the funds, but we don't have a proof of purchase by that same nonprofit. Donovan, you deal with grant funding, around the country you've dealt with this issue. I mean, do we have the proper procedures here? And is it the council member's fault in particular, or is the whole entire system just screwed up?
I think from my experience and also applying for grants through the NDF program, then when I first did with the Chickasaw Neighbor Association, and at the time Councilwoman Green was in office, I explained to them that the grant application process was flawed. And one of the flaws was I did not believe that definitely for on the budget page that it asked for enough detail to explain how an individual is going to be using the money. It pretty much asked for kind of a blanket amount, and kind of that left the
nonprofit organization for interpretation,
to spend the money at will because there's really no direction. So I really don't feel like it's the council. I think it's pretty much the city proper that's really flawed in this particular system. I think, you know, the council person, they should have recognized this and, you know, made some changes upon this. There are people in leadership, and we're looking for intelligent leadership. So definitely it should have been something within the office that someone should have recognized that needs some change before.
Yeah, you said intelligent leadership, this, though.
Yes.
I mean, because the thing with Shanklin, let's be honest, is it wise, if you want to help someone who has a criminal background rehabilitate their life, does it have to be your grandson? I mean, there's no one in District 2 who could use a $34,000 job. There's no one who has maybe a business administration degree or a master's degree in communications who would be better suited for that legislative aid job than your grandson, who clearly was continuing to commit crimes while employed.
Yeah, and that is part, I guess, the heart of the argument, that Dr. Shanklin's a grandmother and she'd do what any other grandmother would do. However, what you have, as you said, Philip, she's in a position, and Donovan, she's in a position of authority. She's in a position of power.
The higher expectation.
There's a higher expectation, and she's held to a higher standard because she is a council person.
Well, Councilman Shanklin at this point is in full shutdown mode. I mean, she initially was going to be on this show, and then declined. She's not doing any face-to-face interviews. She's doing, interviews via email with the newspaper and others, I'm assuming others. Is that wise for her to do? I mean, and also, even though she says she won't be co-hosting it, but there will be a launch of a radio program that was announced. I mean, this seems like eerily similar to what happened last year.
Yeah, I mean, there are glaring similarities. She has a radio show, as did Dr. Green. But what you said, should she be in shutdown mode? As an attorney, my advice would have been to be in shutdown mode in the beginning.
Right.
And it probably could have been handled differently. Maybe written a check, pay the money back, and handle it differently. But, you know, that's hindsight. But what you have, as you guys have alluded to, what you've got is this. You've got a group of individuals that are in their district to say Dr. Shanklin has done so much for the community, and even though it might have been bending of the rules.
Because in the midst of this, voters did reaffirm her.
Absolutely.
I mean, they did. I mean, 48% of the vote, but that was a 3-person race. I mean, voters did just simply reaffirm her last month that this is who we think is best for this job.
And it's always hard to differentiate between someone who does good that's in the position to distribute funds and programs and things, and the mode and method that they've used to distribute those funds. That's where you're going to have the divide, where some are going to say, how can you say these bad things about Dr. Shanklin, and others that say she's still got to follow the rules.
But even though you say that this information came out prior to the election, I would say that was it really timely enough to give voters a true look to make a decision on their vote before the primary? And I think that's hard to say. I don't know if the voters were really informed
or knew about this
particular issue enough to make a valid decision on how they should move forward on it. So I think the voters were still a little bit in the gray on this particular issue to really make that a factor for their vote.
Is there bias involved in this? I mean, since we're going to say that some of this is very similar to what happened last year at the end, I mean, Councilman Green and her supporters were saying part of this is racially motivated. You're already hearing sort of whispers of that now. Here you have another African-American Democrat questioning her spending. People are saying, well, why not question spending by the mayor's office? Why not question, some people have contacted WFPL and say, why don't I see a story about the $1.5 million forgivable loan given to these investors for Whiskey Row? Is there an element of bias in this?
Well, there you go back to everybody's doing it. That's the everybody's doing it argument. Then the question becomes, is that a legitimate argument? Is it bias? You've got two African-American female council people that have been the target or the focus of two articles, and you've got the person that wrote the article that was in another city prior who was perhaps attacking or disagreeing with the mayor of Cincinnati, who's African-American. If you put two and two together, some people put two and two together, come up with five. I can say
personally that was the same argument I got last year. When I did the stories on Councilwoman Green, everyone hated, well, not everyone, her supporters. Yeah. And I think it's just I don't even think it's about the makeup of the individual. This is political. I mean, you're going to go to whatever defense tactic you can go to. And the best tactic, really, at the end of the day, with that type of mountain evidence against Councilwoman Green, she had to go there. There was no real place for her to go. For Shanklin, it might be a bit different. She's not the same political character as Councilwoman Green. She may just simply apologize or write a check to pay back the money. I'm not really sure. But I don't see that happening in the same exact way for Green that it did for Shanklin, just because she behaves a bit differently in her political career.
I hope it doesn't, because I don't think that that would be the best argument to make and the best route to take it, because it's political. When, above all, this is politics. It's hard. It's tough. You've got to make tough decisions, and you've got to dot your I's and cross your T's.
Well, we have to be honest here that when we say it's politics, and when you say politics, we have to say that race is involved in politics. And to discount the racial factor out of the situation, I think would be doing a disservice. I think, because when you have, definitely for me, when I just made a post on the Shanklin story on my Facebook, I got attacked because at that point it became racial towards me. Now you have the black person.
This is people saying what?
That the black person is now taking an opportunity to tear down another black person.
Yeah.
And so, and I'm sure that you got that a lot, and I heard it a lot from you, definitely during the Judy Greene. And so one of my things was, and I've always said, you know, just because I may challenge another black leadership doesn't mean that there's a personal attack on that black leadership, that we have to hold our leadership accountable no matter, and we cannot allow, you know, race to lower the factor of holding that person accountable.
We will see. We'll see how this plays out with Dr. Shanklin, and we'll be able to juxtapose the two situations, whether or not Dr. Shanklin faces an ethics problem, or whether or not she gets through this and remains
in
office.
I mean, but will she get through it?
Yes.
It remains to be seen. Because you said we're dealing with two different people, two different approaches.
But she's on the ropes. I mean,
she's on the ropes.
This editorial cartoons.
She's on the ropes.
I mean,
but
she's getting pummeled by this.
But I think she's handling it differently, and I think that she may have a bit more political capital to be able.
She's a former council president
to withstand this.
So she has that. I mean, she's the first African American council president in 2004. So, yes, you're right. She has a lot more political capital than Green did at the time. But, I mean, people have already called for her resignation in letters. And, I mean, she, at least in my conversations with her, she seems a little bit more wary than she was a month ago.
She needs to be wary.
I mean, because there's more attention on it now than it was a month ago. And so, and I think because a month ago, the story was so, yes, it was just a story, and it was not much follow-up. And then it was pretty, after the primaries, it was like, boom, we're going to really focus on this particular story on Barbara Shanklin. And I think in a lot of ways, and you said compared Judy Greene and Barbara Shanklin compared to other political individuals that you have wrote about in this particular situation, is that how it's written and how it's shared with the public. And in this way, it first came out, it was just so sensational. You know, Barbara Shanklin hires her son who's a fugitive. Now that just caught people's attention, the fugitive. Well, you know, oftentimes I think that word was just stretched when you call the man a fugitive. Because I miss a day in court, and I'm going to go to the next court day, doesn't mean I'm running from the law. And I think I think that made it just so sensationalized when you keep on calling this individual a fugitive. I think that's kind of a misuse of the word, because, you know, you're talking about a fugitive, a person who's making an attempt just to escape law, not necessarily a person who just may have just missed a court date. And so I think, you know, when you have this situation, I think that in Judy Greene, I think it was just so much fanfare behind it that just led to it. I think rather than, I guess, your other political commentary that you may have had.
But and then it goes to what do we have a political appetite for? Mm-hmm. Does the media, do the constituents, do the residents of Louisville have the appetite, the political appetite, to go for another council person? Can the council withstand another scandal? And especially with this last report by Kleppel, with the 117 misuses of funds out there, does the council have a situation that they're going to rally around Dr. Shanklin and say, this could be me next?
Well, Brandon, Donovan, thanks for sharing.
Thanks for having me.
Former UK basketball star Anthony Davis was the first pick in the NBA draft. He is reportedly trying to get his unibrow trademarked. I talked to WFPL's Mark Bacon and Main Event Sports Show host Haven Harrington about politics and money in sports.
We haven't had a college athlete with a physical characteristic or a name like Davis has in a number of years. That's not to say it hasn't existed, and even here in the Commonwealth, when Rex Chapman went to UK, there were King Rex t-shirts that were being sold.
Sexy Rexy.
Sexy Rexy. They were being sold. Rex didn't see a penny.
Yeah, that's the point about this. I think it's serious.
Yeah.
People will say, oh, he's trying to trademark his unibrow. They'll laugh. That's what is funny. But the reality is, the serious issue behind this is that these guys, NCAA players, mm-hmm. particularly in basketball, but football as well, make the universities a whole lot of money.
Yeah, especially football and basketball. And this,
and they get compensated in the sense that they get an education, but they're not getting paid.
No, not really. But they're not really getting compensated, because with all the rules you have against, just, it doesn't count against track and field or golf, but the regulations that's placed on football
and basketball
are a lot stiffer than your other, you know, college athletes.
Even baseball.
And even because, you know, baseball players, you can still be a Major League Baseball player mm-hmm. and still play in college
right.
and get paid for Major League Baseball and still.
And I don't think people will see this story in that way, though. I don't think they'll see this as, here's an individual who, along with other players, made this university a whole lot of money, didn't see that. So every bit of money. And I think isn't that going on, this case with Larry O'Bannon from UCLA is
right,
going on
right.
with using his likeness
for
when he played for UCLA for video games
right.
and for different advertisements, and he's right. still not seeing that money.
That's right.
Even
That's
though
right.
he's no
he's
longer
a Toyota manager. Dealer now, you
yeah.
know, out in
yeah.
California, but he has the right to this, I think. In intellectual property, and I'm no IP attorney, you know, you do own your likeness and your name or your show's name or something like that in most cases. I mean, when you, in 1992, I got to relate this to you as a Cards fan, they had the t-shirt, Rodney Scooter, Me and You, Albuquerque 92. Now, when you bought that, did you think of, you know, Rodney and Scooter, are the McRae's getting anything from this? But it's their name that's selling that.
It's a trade-off.
It is a feeling that, yeah, I'm boosting the team and all this, but it really goes to new levels with Anthony Davis. You go to Rupp Arena, all of a sudden you see kids with mascara pencil, you know, all the way across. And then the t-shirt, the fear of the brow. And that's where I think this whole thing comes through. And this exposes, Philip, the hidden wound in college basketball and college football. Just those two sports.
Because we've got rules now to where we no longer allow a kid to go from – well, he has to make the choice.
He has to make a choice, right.
He can go pro mm-hmm. at a certain point. But I think that the rule now is, what, 18 is the
– you have to complete the, 1 year of college.
1 year of college. So now you have to go to college.
Right.
The high school – to pro, the Kevin Garnetts, the Kobe Bryants, that's no longer an option.
Right. Correct.
So you've taken that out, and people complain about the one and done, but, I mean, Haven, how much of this has to do with, and this is something that people really don't want to talk about, you have mostly African-American men mm-hmm. making a whole lot of money and getting no money for it. There was a system for that 100 so years ago. It was called slavery.
Worked mm-hmm. very well.
Mm-hmm. For the country. Very well for certain people.
Yeah, for the country, it worked out pretty well. For us, not too much. You know, but the thing is about, you know, about the whole one and done rule, to me, I always thought this was enacted by the NBA to kind of placate the NCAA so they can keep making money off of college basketball.
I mean, this is a business.
It's a business.
It's a multi-billion dollar business.
This is the only place in which I know in which you can have a talent, a skill, and you're told you can't make money off that skill until a certain point.
Right.
I mean, we're not telling, you know, 16-year-old girls they can't, you know, be in professional tennis if they're ready to play. I mean, that now
because they're a commodity.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because it's a commodity like uranium that makes the school some money. Beyond that, I don't think there's any care. Let's go back to the 1980s. Bob Knight, who is as old school as they get with coaching and that, comes out with what was thought then an outrageous statement, all these kids should be paid. They should stay in school for 4 years, but they should be paid a stipend across the board. A kid who goes to UK gets paid the same amount as a kid who goes to North Dakota State. And, you know, because if you do it any other way, like if you go to UK, you get more money because they generate. If you go to Pepperdine, you get less because
you kill the lower schools.
That's right.
Yeah,
it's revenue sharing, which is a deadly word.
Which is actually something that the Big Ten Conference has actually suggested for college football players that – you know, we should work out a stipend deal because.
But if you pay them, if you pay the basketball players and the football players, does that mean I have to pay the field hockey team, the soccer team, the baseball team? I mean, part of it is that in college sports, and I know this is going to get under someone's skin, I'm sure. Not to say those aren't sports, but the revenue sports, men's basketball, men's football, and I would say women's basketball.
Women's
too.
Basketball.
It's,
yeah.
It's certainly, I think over the past decades or so, gotten a lot more interest.
That's the holy trinity. For very small schools. But what's happening right now in college athletics, it's football that pays for everything else, pretty much. I mean, there are a couple exceptions. Like University of Louisville is an exception, where the basketball makes more money than the football, and basketball right now kind of rules the rules. I mean, even at UK, which just won a national championship, it's the football team that makes almost twice as much money as the basketball team. And the football team is horrible. But because they're in the biggest football conference, they get the TV revenue from the SEC. The football team actually pays the bills for all of UK's college athletics.
Yeah. I mean, this is the whole issue of college football. I agree that has the ludicrous thing that Boise State may be in the Big East.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like nobody knows geography anymore.
San Diego State's in the Big East. I mean, you can't get further west than San Diego State. Right.
Hawaii. So Hawaii will be in the Big East.
Hawaii will be in the Great Midwest or something. Yeah. You know?
But, I mean, I don't think we're going to let these – I don't think they're going to pay athletes either, though. Well, it's going to have to be a stipend.
No, you're
gonna
have the to point be, you were looking at.
They call it a salary. If they call it a salary and you – that will infuriate the purists in NCAA.
Right.
You have to call it a stipend or maybe enhance some of the stipends that you have already for these guys. Do something, because the idea of paying them gets under people's skin.
Yeah.
In a way that you – it's really interesting to see people who make money, who make a lot of money off of the athletic department, or who don't mind the idea of coaches being paid millions upon millions of dollars in contracts. But the idea of paying the athlete, to them, is sacrilege.
Exactly. Yeah,
but – right now, there is a movement in college athletics, especially on the football side, to give players stipends. And it's just that, a stipend.
The only salary I see, I think, in this issue with Davis, and goes back to the Larry O'Bannon case, is that if you use my likeness once I graduate, I should get paid off of that. That's the only thing I can think of, which is the sort of the mid-level. But I think Real Sports did a story on how when these guys sign these contracts, it literally is universal lifetime contracts. So the contract is applicable in Pluto for all eternity.
Yeah, and you sign everything away.
Mark Bacon, Haven Harrington, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Philip.
Noise and Notes on WFPL is produced by me, Philip Bailey, with Joe Durso. For more, visit WFPL.org.